I'm here with Tom Holland. Tom, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
I'm a huge fan of your work. I have known about your books for some years, but I recently discovered your podcast, which you do with Dominic Sandbrook, a fellow historian, which is fantastic. That's the rest is history. I am working my way through Dominion, which is fantastic. And this came out a few years ago, but I'm well into it. And it's also great as an audiobook, which people should know.
Sam, if I could just say also, I'm just in the process of recording it myself.
Oh, nice.
So I've just been doing that today.
Okay,
so I've just
good.
Gone back from the recording studio.
So don't get the audiobook. Wait for Tom to record it. Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. So yeah, I mean, I don't know if you find that as painful a process as I do, but it's surprisingly
I'm finding it very painful.
Yeah.
Very painful indeed.
I've actually had to rewrite lines that I couldn't get through. I'd inadvertently written tongue twisters for myself. And after 20 takes in front of an ashen-faced producer, I literally have to change the language so that I can neurologically accomplish the task. You've written about ancient Rome, Christianity, as I said, in Dominion, which we'll focus on. But you've also covered the origins of Islam and the problem of jihadism in the West. I just discovered as late as last night the short documentary you did on ISIS, the Islamic State, which was quite something to revisit. It's amazing how the memory of the extremity of that horror has faded for even people who have focused on it at the time. It was just such a ghastly distillation of everything that's wrong with that fanaticism, which we'll talk about. So anyway, there's a ton to cover, and I really want to get your sense as a historian of the echoes of history that we're seeing in the present. I mean, so much of the history that you've covered on your podcast, you have a great series on the French Revolution. I think we're hearing echoes of that in recent years, echoes of the fall of Rome and other concerns. Also, before we started, you told me you have a new translation of Suetonius's Lives of the Caesars coming out in April, which people should look for. Which I didn't realize you're a translator. You translated Herodotus, back in the day, and I look forward to picking that up. So anyway, that's a long introduction. Tom, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
So let's start with the thesis in Dominion, the argument that Christianity is the most enduring legacy of the ancient world, and that many of us who think we were never really indoctrinated in it or by it certainly don't imagine ourselves to be attached to it. A outspoken atheist like myself imagines that his morality was not actually handed to him by Jesus or Paul or medieval Christendom or the Bible thumpers in my own country, with whom I'm even more familiar. You argue that so much of what we take to be natural to us in secular moral terms is really the legacy of Christian ethics. So let's jump in. I don't mean to lead the witness too much, but let's just start with what accounts for the rise and endurance of Christianity on your account.
Well, the rise, nothing comes from nothing. So it is clearly emerges from a confluence of whole kinds of different cultural streams. The most obvious of those, of course, is the inheritance of Hebrew scripture. Jesus is saturated in that, Paul and the first Christians as well. But there is also the influence of Greece, Greek culture, Greek philosophy. Paul writes in Greek and he invokes Greek philosophical concepts and indeed infuses them into his letters. I think that you can discern more distantly, because it is an influence on Hebrew scripture rather than directly on the world of the early church, Persian dualism, the sense that the world and the cosmos is a moral entity, that there are such concepts as good and evil, which the Persians would define as truth and the lie, as light and darkness. And then, of course, there is the context that is provided by the Roman Empire, which is very self-consciously universalist. Virgil, Rome's greatest poet, claims that the Romans have been given empire without limit by the gods. And the physical manifestations of that assumption are the great roads that are starting to be cast like a, you know, the mesh of a net over the various provinces that the Romans have conquered. The shipping lanes have been largely cleared from pirates. And so the world has been joined together in a way that it had never previously been. And Christianity emerges as, in a way that is very conscious of that, that kind of universal dimension. And Paul in this, I think, is the key figure, a Judean raised with a deep knowledge of the scriptures, but also he has a very, very keen awareness of the vastness of the world. And in a sense, he gives to the non-Judeans in the Roman Empire a chance to share in what have already been discerned by many Gentiles as the kind of the spiritual and scriptural riches of the Judean inheritance. And I think in that context, you can see why Christianity would be as successful as it is, because it is absorbing all kinds of elements that are culturally present in the world of the Roman Mediterranean and mixing them in a way that proves very appealing to large numbers of people across the Roman Mediterranean and indeed beyond the Roman Mediterranean into the lands of the Persians as well.
But isn't the appeal still somewhat paradoxical? I mean, this is something that I think you cover in your book, and it's a point that I think Paul made and Nietzsche also made. I mean, I think those are, Paul and Nietzsche could be considered the bookends of Christianity, but both acknowledged how astounding it was that a living God was crucified and that somehow this abject failure within his lifetime to conquer anything became the symbol that so much of the world found spiritually inspiring, right? I mean, there had been this historical precedent of various kings and other figures being acknowledged to be divine, right? Becoming divine at some point in their lives or just, you know, claiming to be divine. And yet they're not the center of a 2,000-year-old cult or you know, worldwide religion. So let's linger for a moment just on the strangeness of the Jesus story.
Yeah, it's incredibly strange. And as you say, the strangeness is not the idea that a man can in some way also be divine, because most people in the Roman world take that for granted. And in fact, the fastest growing cult in the first century AD is not Christianity, but the cult of another man who was thought to be the son of a god, who proclaimed good news, who claimed to rule over an age of peace, and who, when he died, was believed to have ascended to heaven to sit at the right hand of his father. And this is Caesar Augustus, the man who rules effectively as the first emperor, the son of Julius Caesar, who brings peace to a world that had been ravaged by civil war. And the achievements of Augustus are what raise him to the heavens. The Romans, and indeed many in the provinces, feel that his achievements are of a divine order. The idea that someone who, it's not just that Jesus was an unimportant provincial from a backwater, but the fact that he had suffered a peculiarly horrible death. Crucifixion was the paradigmatic fate that was visited on slaves because it was not only agonizing, but it was also publicly humiliating. And in a sense, humiliation for the Romans was seen as being almost more terrible than physical pain. And you're right that, in a sense, Paul and Nietzsche do kind of bookend this sense, because in Paul's letters, again and again, you get a sense of utter shock that this could have happened. Paul's letters are not kind of a cool, measured articulation of doctrine. He is wrestling with a sense of overwhelming astonishment that in some way the one God of Israel has been made manifest as someone who suffered this hideous death. And it kind of blows his mind, and he's endlessly trying to make sense of it. I think what then happens over the course of the Christian centuries that follow is that It takes Christians a long time to get over the shock and horror of this. It's really notable that through the early centuries, Christians do feel, yeah, this is embarrassing. I mean, they continue to feel unsettled by it. And even once Constantine has become a Christian and the Roman Empire starts to become institutionally Christianized, this sense of embarrassment remains. Mm. And
I think you say in the book, this is a fact that had never occurred to me to even wonder about, but it took some centuries before the depiction of Christ on the cross became really admissible.
Right. So, I mean, one of the earliest ones that is done by, so there's a very early one that is done by someone mocking Christianity. So it shows a man with an ass's head being crucified. It comes from graffiti in Rome, and it's clearly mockery. One of the earliest illustrations by Christians comes on an ivory box that's now in the British Museum, and it shows the passion. So on one side, you have Judas being hanged and looking very unhappy about it. On the other side, you have Christ on the cross, and he couldn't look more chilled. Mm-hmm. I mean, he looks like he's hanging out in California on a beach. Mm-hmm. He's buff, he's toned, he's got a kind of loincloth on. And in fact, what he looks like, of course, is an athlete who has won in a great contest, which is one of the ways that in the Roman world, Christ's victory over death is understood. And it's not for another 500 years after that, so just before the first millennium, that you get Christ portrayed as dead on the cross. Mm. And then throughout the High Middle Ages, there is a very deep and intense fascination on the part of Christians with the physical sufferings of Christ, with his passion. And then I think people, artists and thinkers and writers in the Christian world, push it to such a limit that almost they become desensitized to it. And by the 19th century, when Nietzsche is writing, I think that most people probably going into a church and looking at a cross are not thinking of it as an absolutely hideous instrument of torture, and they're probably not visualizing the appalling sufferings that a man nailed to it would have undergone. And it's a kind of paradox, a very Nietzschean paradox, that probably the most devastating, you know, to Christian faith, the most devastating atheist who's ever written in the Christian tradition, Friedrich Nietzsche, should have felt the power of the cross so profoundly, and he feels it as something disgusting. He feels it perhaps in the sense that a Greek or Roman would. The idea that someone who had suffered such a servile fate could in any way be worthy of approbation, let alone worship, appalls Nietzsche, because he sees it as an offense against the values of strength and power and glory and beauty that he identifies in Greek and Roman culture, and which frankly he thinks has been corrupted by Christianity, this faith of slaves, as he describes it. And one of the reasons he describes it as the faith of slaves is because crucifixion is the fate that is visited on slaves. And when I was writing Dominion, I was about two chapters through, and then I got a commission to make this film that you mentioned in your introduction about the Islamic State. And I ended up going to this town called Sinjar, which had been the home of people called the Yazidis. I'm sure you'll know, I'm sure lots of people listening will know, people who were accused by the Islamic State, not just of being infidels, but of being devil worshippers, and had been treated peculiarly horribly. And the women had been rounded up, and those who were thought too ugly to take off as sex slaves had been killed, and those who hadn't had been taken off and sold into sexual slavery. But the men, some of them had been crucified. And to be in a town that had been liberated just a few weeks before by the Kurds, and the Islamic State were a couple of miles away from where we were, across kind of blank, open fields, to be in a town where people had suffered crucifixion at the hands of people who viewed crucifixion as the Romans had viewed it, as a fate that it was not just the right of the powerful to visit on the defeated, but a moral duty, I found kind of existentially horrible. And I suppose it kind of opened my mind to the sense in which I think the idea that someone who is tortured to death has a moral value over the person who tortures him to death underpins my moral system. And I think the moral system of the vast number of people in the West. And I came back and I rewrote the introduction to the book to focus on the crucifixion as being the kind of maddest, strangest, weirdest symbol that anyone in antiquity came up with. And it may not be a coincidence that it is, of course, the most enduring symbol, probably the best known symbol maybe in world history.
Yeah. I mean, one thing you get from reading history, certainly reading Dominion, or any, your other, I guess, Rubicon conveys it too, your discussion of Rome, is just how foreign and through a modern lens, pathological the ethics of antiquity were, right? I mean, just I think, is it Thucydides who said that the strong do what they will and the weak suffer what they must? Or some that's probably close to the translation.
A phrase that is being quoted a lot at the moment, it must be said.
And yeah, I mean, so you actually make that point in your documentary on the Islamic State as you're walking through Sinjar, that this was a promulgation of a Roman ethic, essentially. I mean, I think you say something like they murdered these people very much the way, you know, the Roman legions would have, or there's some line like that, direct comparison to Rome, which I found briefly shocking because I realize I rarely view the Greeks and Romans through this lens of moral judgment, the same kind of judgment I lavish upon jihadists, right? But yet there's something awful about their ethics and their celebration of strength over weakness.
I mean, that is a perspective that I would argue is shaped by 2,000 years of Christian weathering, because, I mean, Nietzsche certainly saw the morality of the Greeks and the Romans as something admirable, as of course in due course did Hitler.
Yeah.
But it's wrong to say that the Romans are immoral. They weren't at all. They saw themselves as the most moral of peoples, and this is why the gods had given them the rule of the world. And
also, you read like the Stoic philosophers, right? And it's you're in the presence of some of the greatest wisdom philosophy has ever produced, and yet to know of the normalcy of crucifixion occurring in the background is peculiar.
I mean, I think so. As a child, I always found Greece and Rome infinitely more glamorous than the Israelites and than the apostles. So I was always team Pharaoh, team Nebuchadnezzar, team Pontius Pilate. I kind of thrilled to the glamour and the swagger of these ancient civilizations, rather in the way that I'd thrilled to the glamour and the swagger of tyrannosaurs as an even younger child. And I guess that I was perfectly capable of being thrilled and excited by the thought of the Spartans at Thermopylae or Caesar conquering Gaul. And I would do that in part by also identifying my moral inheritance as something that derived from Greek philosophy. But I guess that one of the, probably the main thing that led me to write Dominion, A History of Christianity, which I had never been on my agenda. I always I had a kind of almost synesthetic sense of antiquity. And I thought of Greece and Rome as with bright blue Californian skies. And I thought of Christianity as, you know, the drizzle of an English autumn setting in and blotting out the sun. But I realized as I wrote about Caesar, who was hailed as a great man by his fellow citizens for inflicting hundreds of thousands of casualties during the course of the conquest of Gaul, enslaving an equal number and kind of exulting in it, and realizing that this really wasn't my moral system at all. And I felt it was kind of like, you know, I suppose the kind of the prickle in the back of the throat that heralds the onset of a cold, the sense that something was kind of, that I couldn't quite get a handle on was waiting to take me over. And I began to think, well, is it actually Christianity that changes? Is that what explains the process of transformation? And I explored it in the third work of history I wrote, which was focused very much on what I think is a kind of great process of revolution in 11th century Latin Christendom, so the western half of what had been the Roman Empire. And it's often called the Papal Revolution because the revolutionaries are people who take control of the Roman Church, and it's led by popes. And it forces through a kind of very radical process of a recalibration of society that essentially divides the world into rival spheres that in due course in the West is what we call religion and the secular. And this is a division that did not exist in antiquity. It didn't exist in any other of the civilizations of Eurasia. And I enjoyed the paradox that secularism would not probably have been secularism without the labors of 11th century popes. Mm. It seemed to me a very entertaining paradox. Mm. So I explored that. And then on the back of that, I then became interested in what was the role of Islam in all of this. And I wrote a book on Islam where I was quite skeptical about quite a lot about early Islam.
This is In the Shadow of the Sword?
In the Shadow of the Sword. Yeah. So it seemed to me that the great question about Islam is, where does the Quran come from? And it is amazing the number of books by very distinguished scholars, so it's not even kind of popular history, who will say about the revelations, Muhammad received the Quran.
From the Archangel Gabriel? That's the
scholarly opinion of the
Academy? Well, they don't
necessarily
say
that. They don't say that, but they might say he received the revelations, and they leave it at that. Hmm. And I thought, well, that's not really an adequate explanation. If you're not a Muslim, right. I mean, if you're a Muslim, then of course it's perfectly adequate. I mean, you know, that's the foundation of a Muslim's faith. But if you're not, you've got to say, where does it come from? And it did seem to me that the Quran was, I mean, if the Quran had materialized in, I don't know, 15th century New Zealand, I mean, that would be a miracle. Mm. It would be incredible. But the fact that it materializes in a place that is rife with Jewish and Christian and Zoroastrian and Roman and Persian and all kinds of cultural influences, and that this is exactly what it reflects, made me think that Islam was a product of this, but one that had gone on a radically different direction from Christianity. And so thinking that and studying it and kind of reifying my thoughts about how what today we would call Judaism and Christianity and Islam and Zoroastrianism were kind of related, but quite radically different in their presumptions, again, sharpened for me the sense of what was distinctive about Christianity and my own sense of being very, very shaped by it. And so that's how I then came to write Dominion. Mm. And Dominion was a process of stress testing that theory, because when I began it, I wasn't entirely sure what conclusions I would end up with.
Mm. Well, I want to get to Islam, as I said, but let's linger here on the connection that you argue for between Christian ethics and secular ethics that many of us imagine to be, quite denuded of any, propositional claim about the truth or necessity of Christianity. Someone like myself, I move through the world having various moral intuitions informed by just my own thought and then just my collision with the history of ideas, whether it's Western philosophy or Eastern philosophy or religions like Christianity. But that amalgam translates in my thinking into something that has no necessary connection, certainly, to Christianity. So let me just throw a few, or try to create a few wrinkles in that picture. One is that, so when you take Christianity itself, the early Christians, from Jesus onward, first of all, they were Jews, and I think it's reasonably safe to say that the earliest ones, I guess beyond Paul, this changes, but the earliest ones, certainly Jesus and the apostles, never imagined they were doing anything but practice the real Judaism, right? I mean, they weren't Christians. In some sense, this is Judaism in practice, this slave morality that Nietzsche derided.
I think it's difficult to tell because the earliest texts that we have are Paul's letters. I mean, we simply don't have any earlier texts.
Right.
So if you're looking at the Gospels, they are a few decades later, and there are huge arguments about when to date them that I feel unqualified to opine upon.
Mm.
people study them for their entire lives and still can't agree. So I don't feel that really in a position to say.
I guess if you just
but what I would say about Paul's letters is that it seems to me that there is evidence within those letters for kind of earlier traditions, that there are prayers and formulae that seem not that are thought by most scholars to predate the letter that Paul is writing. And I think that they reflect what scholars would call quite a strong Christology, namely the idea that Jesus is in some way Christ, the anointed one. And I think there is a kind of weirdness there, as there is a kind of weirdness around Muhammad, the very early Muslim notion that Muhammad has received revelations. We, as far as we know, there is kind of no moment in the early history of Islam where people who call themselves who hail Muhammad as a prophet don't think that the Quran is in some way divine. And why they think that, I think, from the historical point of view, is a mystery. And I think the same is true of the...
Well, isn't there the claim that Muhammad was illiterate? So just his being able to versify was in itself a miracle?
I think that word probably means that he is not versed in scripture. Hmm. And I think it refers to the fact that the Bible, which we now know, certainly monotheism is very, very prevalent throughout Arabia.
Mm.
But there is no translation to Arabic of the Bible. And I think that is what that word means. But I'm starling off and leaving the early history of Christianity behind.
Yeah.
I think there is a kind of strangeness and a weirdness around Christian ideas from the very beginning. And I think that's what you'd expect, because what you see in Paul and what you see transcribed in the Acts of the Apostles is a readiness to suffer any amount of persecution, including death, to stick up for something that these people clearly passionately, passionately believe.
Mm. Yeah, that
it's true, but it does seem to me that the weirdness of it, the strangeness, is something that should be factored into explaining why it succeeds in the way that it does.
That is one piece of weirdness, the willingness of people to die on his account some decades after, when this was still a comparatively tiny cult. And yeah, I mean, those first decades, you know, the first century after Christ is a strange time, which...
Well, so I think also what you asked right at the beginning, why does it work?
Mm.
I think in a sense, there is a lot of kindling waiting for a spark. And I think that kindling, again, goes back to this idea, I think, that I briefly mentioned, that there is a lot of enthusiasm in Greek and Roman society, both elite and kind of lower down, in the notion of a personal God. And the reason for that is that Greek and Roman cults don't really offer that.
Mm.
Greek and Roman cults are essentially a form of insurance that a city will take out against disaster. So you have to offer up what the Romans called religiones, so bonds that would join you to a god, whether that's a sacrifice or a feast day or a celebration or whatever, a priesthood. But there's not a huge amount of consolation to be found by offering up sacrifice to Jupiter for someone who is poor or suffering or bereaved or whatever. But the Judean God does seem to offer that. And so you have a number of people who do undergo circumcision if they're men, but also people who are not willing to take that step, but they're kind of God-fearers, by which people who are interested in this idea of a kind of personal God. And you can see why the message preached by Paul would seem literally God-sent to people like that, because you can have the personal God, and you don't have to be circumcised
without being circumcised.
You know, and you can still eat. You know, you can still eat lobster. And the Romans did love their seafood.
I think he doesn't. That's one place where Paul clearly breaks with the tradition of Judaism, where he goes on and on about just the absurdity of this tradition. Right? I mean, doesn't he analogize it to castration and?
I don't think he sees it as ridiculous. I mean, he believes in the covenant that Moses had been given.
Mm.
It's just that his explanation for what the crucifixion represents is that there is now a new covenant, and that
yeah.
God's law is written on the heart. And the measure of how weird this is and how unexpected is that he has to reach for the Stoic word for this. The Stoics had the sense of a spark of the divine being present in every human being, because they were essentially, it was a kind of pantheist faith. And he uses this to explain what he means, that everybody has a sense in their heart of what is right, of what is God's law. And this is what I guess today we would call conscience. It's an idea that if you want to know the right way to live, you look into your heart and there you will find it. And I think that the legacy of that is with us to this day.
Yeah, he also solidifies the attachment to the miracle of the resurrection. I mean, you know, I forget where it occurs in Paul's letters, but he has all that over. Line, if Christ be not raised, your faith is vain, right? I mean, it's an absolutely non-negotiable tenet of Christianity that the resurrection physically occurred and death was defeated in the case of Christ.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Without that, then it's folly and foolishness.
Yeah. Okay, so another wrinkle I'll attempt to introduce here. What do you do with the multi-century period of horror that followed the papal revolution you just celebrated? When we look at the ethical character of medieval Christendom, which I think, as you describe in Dominion, as a culture of persecution or a society of persecution. I mean, one can argue, as I have when I was in the business of arguing about the questionable truth and efficacy of Abrahamic faith, that the logic of the Inquisition, what was explicitly given, if not in the gospel, is certainly given by the leading lights of the Catholic Church, Aquinas and Augustine. So when you look at the mad work of the Inquisitors for several centuries in medieval Europe, and you wonder, how is it possible that the moral genius and pacifist who gave us, you know, turn the other cheek and the Beatitudes, had his teachings so fully perverted so as to justify the witch trials and the crazy tortures of the Inquisition? You need only look to Augustine and Aquinas to get an explicit rationale for it. What do you do with that? If this is the wellspring of what is best in us morally in the secular West, how did it pass through the bottleneck of Christendom?
Well, I'm not saying that it's necessarily the legacy of Christianity is for good. It's for good and ill.
Mm.
But I would also say that those standards of good and ill are defined for us by Christianity, by and large.
Right.
Because to look specifically at the question of how Latin Christendom, in the wake of this extraordinary revolutionary period in the 11th century and going into the 12th century, becomes a persecuting society, I think that it happens for reasons that are replicated throughout subsequent European and then Western history. So essentially, the revolution in the 11th century is an attempt by leading figures in the Roman Church to seize control of the whole of the church, and to wash society in the waters of baptism in the way that an individual might be, to cleanse it of sin. And this is why the notion of there being a dimension of religio, of the bond that joins the Christian people to the eternity of heaven, is counterpointed to what they call the dimension of the saeculum, which is all things that are born and then must die, that are corruptible, that are fallen, that are tainted by death and sin. And it's a very, for lots and lots of people, it is an exciting, inspiring message. And there are people who swing behind it, and who kings are humbled. So famously, the emperor, Henry IV, is made to kneel in snow outside the castle where the Pope, Gregory VII, is installed. It inspires vehement enthusiasm on the part of those who think that they are mandated by God to spread this message and to target the enemies of this revolutionary understanding of God. And of course, the most notorious expression of that instinct is the Crusades. And it inspires a desire on the part of scholars to work out what are the laws, the frameworks of law, that should govern this new understanding of a society that has been consecrated to God. And people gather in institutions that are universally open to scholars from across Western Europe, from across Latin Europe, and these therefore come to take on the name of universities. And in these universities, frameworks of law are derived that enshrine notions that human beings have rights and that the knowledge of God can be fathomed by working out the rational frameworks that must underpin the functioning of his universe. So it's a very, very profound cultural and moral revolution. And those at its cutting edge are concerned to prosecute it. But they find that they face two bodies of enemy within Christendom. So setting aside the Crusades, they have people who want the revolution to go even further and feel that that the church is dragging its feet, that perhaps over the course of time, that it is, rather than being the embodiment of this kind of revolutionary spirit, that it's actually acting as an anchor on it. And then equally, there are people who are appalled and offended by what is happening and don't want their familiar routines, their familiar understanding of God's purposes to be upended, and who therefore have to be coerced and bullied into accepting it. And I think that you can see there a license for morally infused violence that will be a constant, not just through medieval history, but into the modern period as well. So you will get it in the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. You will get it in the French Revolution. You will get it in the Russian Revolution. You might almost say that you would get it in 21st century America, not in any comparable scale of violence, but the sense that people who are at the cutting edge of a radical new understanding of what society should be, of how it should be cleansed, of how it should be purified, people who would claim to have awoken from the slumber of racism and sexism and whatever, and who are constantly, you know, one year's body of radicals is next year's body of sexists or racists. And likewise, people who are very anxious about people who rejected it completely and who could be labelled as deplorables. This is exactly the kind of anxiety that you're seeing from inquisitors in faced with people they call the Cathars or whatever. Mm-hmm. I am not arguing in Dominion that everything good in Western society derives from Christianity and that therefore Western society is good. I'm saying that the patterns of behaviour, the understanding of what good and bad is, the ways in which understandings of good and bad affect how society is then prone to repeated convulsions, that this is not a given. And therefore, it derives from a very distinctive culture, I think. And I think that that culture is not just a Christian culture, but a specifically Latin Christian culture, because you don't see parallels to the Reformation that you get in the 11th century and then in the 16th century, say, in the Orthodox Church. Mm-hmm. And it's telling, I think, that the great schism that happens between Rome and Constantinople, between the Latin and the Greek churches, happens in the 11th century as well, exactly as this process of revolution in Rome is really taking fire.
So the argument you're making for the contingent fact that basically everything we recognize to be morality in ourselves and in the secular West came from Christianity, it's adjacent to a more strident claim being made by many today, and this is a bridge to Islam here, which is that it's just not a contingent fact of history that this influence propagated for the last 2,000 years, but it's a claim that there is no other path to what we recognize to be Western secular enlightened morality, you know, like a universal conception of human rights, say, but for Christianity or but for the Judeo-Christian tradition. And people would make that stronger claim, and they would say there in the current context, we need a reversion to, you know, explicitly Christian faith at greater scale to resist the tension being applied to Western secular open societies by Islam and by by the migration of from the Muslim world into Europe in particular, and that some of America's immunity to the difficulties of Western Europe in assimilation at this moment is a result of its own, of its greater foothold in religiosity, its own Christian religiosity, right? So that that Christianity is a necessary bulwark. I mean, people would tend to say Judeo-Christianity, but really, you know, at scale, we're talking about Christianity, is a necessary bulwark against the Islamization of the world. I just want you to, to react to that claim, and perhaps we, you can, I mean, there's more to talk about in your experience of writing in the shadow of the sword and just what it's like to touch this topic in the first place.
Again, when I talk of Christianity as the water in which we as goldfish swim, I use it rather in the way that you might talk about the Islamic world. And the Islamic world, of course, is full of complexity and contradiction, though there have been many different expressions of Islam. And so likewise, the legacy of Christianity is full of paradoxes and complications and contradictions. So in Dominion, my last chapter, I look at the great migration crisis in Europe that saw Angela Merkel open the borders of Germany and let, kind of a million people of mainly Muslim background into Germany.
Which was a quasi-Christian ethic.
I think in Merkel's case, I think more than quasi. I mean, she was the daughter of a Lutheran pastor whose sense of mission was such that while most Germans in East Germany were heading to West Germany, I mean, he went the opposite direction and ended up behind the Iron Curtain. So she would have grown up very aware of the parable of the Good Samaritan. And the whole point of that is that the Samaritans and the Judeans were inveterate enemies. The idea that a Samaritan would care for a Judean who'd been left broken on the side of a road was madness because they hated each other. And therefore, essentially, it's a narrative expression of Jesus's claim that you should love your enemy. And
In Angela Merkel's case, it was brought to an excruciatingly fine point politically and morally in the presence of a weeping girl from, if memory serves, Syria. And she's denying this girl entrance to the West and salvation, only to then just find that politically and morally untenable.
Yeah. And I think that the power of Christianity. And I think this is often missed by people who kind of go through it looking for chunks of doctrine that they can criticize. The real power of Christianity and the way that it has impacted how people think and behave over many, many centuries is most powerfully articulated and framed within stories. And there is, of course, the overarching story of the life and then the passion and the resurrection of Jesus in the Gospels. But you do also have stories told by Jesus himself. And you would have to say that in their impact, these are the most successful and impactful short stories ever told. Mm-hmm. And I would say that the story of the Good Samaritan has, you know, could rank up there as one of the, as astonishingly impactful. And I think that just as Merkel was influenced by that little girl, I think that she was influenced by this story, whether overtly or subliminally. And I think that the impact of the story of the Good Samaritan is manifest in vast swathes of opinion, not just in Western Europe, but in the United States as well. And it's why so many people are opposed to the policies that the Trump administration are currently instituting. And it seems to me for very, very Christian reasons. But equally, in that when Merkel opened the borders, there was another approach to the influx of refugees, which you saw evidenced in Hungary, where Viktor Orban also, an atheist who basically, he claims to be Christian. I'm not entirely convinced that he is. But he said, we're not having all these Muslims come in, put up borders, refuse to let them in. And he did that as the leader of a country that for centuries had been under Ottoman occupation and so therefore had no sentimental notion of Islam whatsoever. And of course, throughout Christian history, the notion that it's the duty of Christians to defend what used to be called Christendom, defend the church, that the question of what do you do with people who are not like you, this too is a very Christian response. And it can also, you can also find justification for it in scripture. You can find it in the book of Revelation. Christ there wields a sword. Mm-hmm. In the Gospels, he says he comes not to bring peace, but to bring a sword. And civilizations are very, very complex things in which people can derive a whole range of instincts. But I guess my argument is that those instincts, in all their range, their complexity, their paradoxical quality, they derive from Christianity, from Christian stories, from Christian scriptures, from Christian assumptions, from Christian historical experience. They don't derive really and ultimately from any other source in antiquity, I think, because I think the weathering effects of Christianity have been that profound.
Yeah, again, that's it's two ways of hearing that claim. I hear you making the historically contingent claim that this is just a fact about us in the West, whereas some people would say it's the necessary claim that there is no other source of wisdom, equivalent wisdom, to take the positive side of these of the morality. I know you're not endorsing everything that every inheritance of Christianity, but all that is good in us morally could come from no other source. And there, I would just point out that it's very easy to see other sources of a universal conception of compassion and a call toward self-transcendence, if not, you know, slave morality per se, to follow Nietzsche, but a transcendence of self-interest and egotism. And it's, you know, it precedes Christianity. I mean, look to Buddhism, right? You know, 500 BC. I mean, this is now contemporary with or even preceding the glory of Athens. You had an explicit teaching that was, you know, perhaps the most articulate teaching we have about the primacy of compassion and the necessity of self-transcendence. And if you want to take it, you know, too far in my view, but still further than any Christian pacifist has ever taken it, you can look to Jainism, you know, which is a contemporary of Buddhism, where you get just an utter commitment to pacifism of the Gandhian sort. In fact, as you, I'm sure you know, Gandhi was inspired in his conception of ahimsa directly from the Jains, not the Hindus. His mother was Jain. And that, you know, there's a direct line from Gandhi to Martin Luther King Jr. I mean, Martin Luther King Jr. got his approach to pacifism not from Christianity per se, but from Gandhi. So again, the claim I would make is that there's something deeper than culture here. I mean, these are just ideas that can be discovered independently in different cultures, and there's no exclusive authorship of the most pacific in us, or the wisest in us, or the most compassionate in us, or the most self-transcending in us that derives from Christianity. I mean, again, it may be historically contingent to say that if you drop down in your time machine into 16th century England, the moral intuitions you would find there from the most enlightened people would be Christian, genealogically. But there are other ways of arriving at similar insights. That's what I would argue for.
Well, I wouldn't deny it. I've just come back from Japan and was reading some of the great classics that were written there in the early 11th century, particularly The Tale of Genji by Murasaki. And in that, there is, you know, it's unbelievable to think that this great novel was written at the same time as the Vikings were busy attacking England. Yeah. I mean, it just seems impossible to believe it.
Yeah.
But in that, there are moments that are kind of recognizable to someone familiar with Christian literature in the 11th century in England, because Murasaki, who gets her name from the heroine of The Tale of Genji. So Murasaki in the novel, she wants enlightenment. So she wants the world to dissolve away, but at the same time, she doesn't want to lose Genji, and Genji doesn't want to lose her. And so they both hold, what is it, the Amida Buddha, the idea that they can be born into a paradise, and that in this paradise they can be joined, and then when they die in the paradise, then they will attain enlightenment. And that idea of a kind of a personal salvation where you will be joined with your loved one in paradise. I mean, there are, you know, that is clearly expressive of a yearning that Christianity as well is satisfying. So I, you know, of course, there are the yearning of humans, I think, for a sense of the divine is universal. Mm. However, we are not in the West influenced by Buddhism. The fact that, you know, Richard Gere became a Buddhist is not until recently to explain the statue. Yeah. And so as a result, I don't think that that in any way invalidates an argument that the beliefs that most of us hold in what was the Christian West reflect the contingent nature of the history of the West. And you're right that you can respond to that perhaps in two ways. Well, three ways. I mean, I think you can say, well, that is interesting. You know, that's just as humans have evolved from furry creatures running around Mesozoic jungles, so likewise, atheists and secularists and agnostics in the modern West and progressives have evolved from early Christians. I mean, it's just the way history works and operates. So that's one way. Another way would be to say, well, if, you know, I hold these beliefs, I believe in all this stuff, what basis do I have for this? It seems to me that the foundations are kind of pretty shaky if there isn't some transcendent supernatural justification for them. So therefore, perhaps I should see it as the manifestation of the truth of Christianity. I mean, and I know that people have read Dominion in that light, but also it could give you a kind of Nietzschean sense that everything is relative, everything is contingent, that there is no absolute morality, because of course it is perfectly possible to go through the scriptures of the Jains and the Hindus and the Buddhists and Islam and take out bits that, if you stitch them together like a kind of Frankenstein monster, will correspond to the moral intuitions and assumptions that one has as someone raised in a Western society. I mean, it's possible to do that, but you could also find very different things. And I think that the things that you tend to look for as a secular progressive in other spiritual and religious traditions are conditioned by your upbringing in the Christian West. People tend not to look to Greek or Roman or Viking traditions or those of the Assyrians or the Egyptians.
It's probably good.
But you could.
We've left the Vikings aside and the Assyrians.
But of course, you know, we have experience in the 20th century of people who did exactly that in the form of the Nazis.
Yeah.
Because, or the fascists more broadly, the fascists took their name from the fasces, the rods and the axes borne on the shoulders of the bodyguards who looked after Roman magistrates. Mm-hmm. And fascism was a fusion of nostalgia for the pre-Christian classical world in all its glory and cruelty and terror and power and might. And this is articulated very powerfully by Nietzsche. He felt the tug of that very strongly.
Yeah.
And so did many, many fascists. But also simultaneously, an exaltation that Christianity can be put on the dung heap and celebrate modernity, the power and the glory of steel, of speed, of everything that the modern world gives. And I think that, for me, nothing suggests more powerfully the irreducible hold of Christian morality on even the seemingly post-Christian West than the fact that Nazism in particular has replaced the legions of hell in our imaginings, that Hitler has replaced Satan. And the reason for that is that the fascists uniquely did what neither the Russian revolutionaries nor the French revolutionaries nor the philosoph of the Enlightenment did, which was to attack the morality of Christianity. They might have attacked the institutions of Christianity, but they did not target the two manifestations of Christian assumptions that I think have been most radical in the context of antiquity and the most enduring in our Western sense of what is right. And the first of those is this notion that the strong should care for the weak, manifest in the image of Christ on the cross. And the second is the Pauline idea that in Christ there is no Jew or Greek. In other words, that the Christian message is for everybody, and that the differences of race should properly be dissolved. That, after all, is what Catholic means. Catholicos means universal.
Yeah.
And again, the Nazis and the fascists absolutely repudiate that. Of course, they think that Jews and Greeks there are profound differences there. Mm. And that the corollary of that has been that even as institutional Christianity fades, certainly in Europe and maybe even in America now, the conviction that racism is the worst of sins and that it is the moral responsibility of the good person to care for those who are weak has not been diminished in the slightest, and I think has been only sharpened by revulsion and horror at what the Nazis represented. But we feel the horror and revulsion that we do at the Nazis rather than, say, communists, because that revulsion is shaped by the Nazi repudiation of those fundamental Christian doctrines.
Hmm. Well, as you know, there's another faith that is vying for universality and has almost as many subscribers as Christianity at the moment, and that is Islam, which you and I have both written and spoken about. And I think we could commiserate on a shared experience of just how controversial it is to do yeah. that. It's yeah. I don't you know, we need not belabor the topic here, but I'm wondering how you view this slow motion and in places, you know, very swift collision between Western secularism and norms of liberal tolerance and open societies and traditional Islam in its various forms at the moment. And it, I guess the Western European experience is, I think, of most concern to many people, but I'm just wondering how you view it as a historian and as someone who's living through it. You know, you live in the UK. What's your sense of the failures of assimilation and what that implies? And I guess the other piece here is the degree to which a reaction to all of that, a reaction to immigration, you know, being less regulated than perhaps it should be, is empowering these right wing and even in places quasi-fascist ghosts of the past.
Well, I think that I think the great genius of Christianity, in a way, a bit like the devil, is to convince people that it no longer exists.
Mm.
By which I mean that what the period of Western hegemony meant for the rest of the world was that assumptions and morals and notions of what was right were exported to countries that had never previously experienced them. And for a whole host of reasons to do with cynicism or opportunism or general conviction, genuine conviction, Europeans and Americans discovered that the best way to export these convictions was to pretend that they were not Christian, but universal.
Mm.
And of course, a passionate Christian would think that there was no contradiction between that. But it became evident that if you could proclaim that all humans had inherent rights as someone who was speaking for the United Nations rather than as a believing Christian, people who were not from Christian civilizations were much likelier to take it on board. And ever since the Second World War, the language of Western geopolitics and of morality has not been overtly Christian. It has rejoiced in the conceit that the values of the West are to be equated with self-evident values that everybody across the world could share in.
I think you to remind you of a point I think you make in the book, in the discussion of Angela Merkel and her throwing open the gates of Europe to mass immigration and in the aftermath of the Syrian civil war. She claimed that it was just obvious that these people coming into Europe could be just as secular and easily assimilated as anyone. And that is a kind of, you know, certainly from the Orban perspective, a delusion. And I think you make the case that it's an all too Christian delusion. I mean, it's just the idea notion, the separation of secular and religious that is so now common under the aegis of Christianity could be easily mapped on to the Muslim world.
I mean, I think it's very, very arrogant. And I think that we in the West have been arrogant for centuries because we have been culturally as well as economically and militarily so dominant. And now that dominance is coming to an end. And I think we're having to recognize that values that we had assumed were universal and self-evident are not at all, that they're very, very culturally conditioned. And I think there is a huge measure of arrogance in assuming that Western politicians and societies can construct a big tent that is big enough to enfold within it peoples from other civilizational traditions, which are just as rich, just as complex, just as nuanced, and just as distinctive as our own culture. Now, having said that, I think there is a case that these assumptions have had a weathering effect on Islam, and certainly on Muslims who have come to the West, because what Western societies offer Muslims, as earlier in the 19th century, they had some countries offered Jews, was freedom of religion. And the notion of religion is taken for granted by most politicians, I think, in the West today as something self-evident, that there are religions. Christianity is a religion, but there is something called Judaism, there is something called Islam, there's something called Hinduism that is a religion. But this is an assumption that is bred of this, again, this revolution that goes back to the 11th century, this sense that the world can be divided into the dimension of the seculum, the dimension of the religion, of religio, which by the 18th, 19th century has become the idea that there is a dimension called the secular and the dimension called of religion, and that therefore everybody in the world has to have a religion.
Well, also European on the flip side powers, of that, everyone in the world has to acknowledge that there is a space for the secular, whereby the contest between religions are relinquished.
Yes. And so in the French Revolution, when Jews are offered citizenship of France, they become part of the French people, which means that they have to surrender their self-identity as members of the nation of Israel, which is how they had previously seen themselves, and come to think of themselves as members of the French nation who belong to a religion that is called Judaism. And that requires quite a process of adaptation for Jews. And it's, as we know, often a very troubled one. And for Muslims, likewise, coming to the West, they're offered freedom of religion. But again, it presupposes the idea that what they, you know, that they are no longer part of the Ummah, part of the House of Islam, the global community of Muslims, but they are British or French or American or Germans who practice a religion called Islam. And it obliges Muslims to interiorize this notion that derives from Christianity, that there is a secular space where religion shouldn't intrude. And this is something that is profoundly antithetical to the traditions of Islam as they were classically practiced. But I think it is true that the West's cultural influence has been so preponderant for so long that it has kind of, it's influenced the world of Islam sufficiently profoundly that you can't really go back to the world that existed for Islam prior, say, to Napoleon's invasion of Egypt, when the West first started conquering and subduing the Muslim world. And it's evident that really that there are two alternatives open to Muslims. There is the policy of accommodation to this notion that Islam is a religion, that you can have secular spaces, that Muslims should accept an Islam that is peripheral to the secular mainstream in the way that Christianity is and other kind of forms of faith. Or you can have a kind of reaction to this and try and go back to basics, to the fundamentals. But even that, the notion that you have, you know, you can be a fundamentalist, that also is to follow a Christian example, because the original fundamentalists were Protestants who were so appalled and offended by, you know, the impact of Darwinism or whatever, that they said, well, we've got to go back and take the Bible literally and, you know, try and work out exactly, you know, treat it like a kind of, I don't know, the equivalent of an instruction manual or something. And that is what Islamic fundamentalists have been doing as well. So I think it's a very, very complicated situation where secular Western countries don't even realize the pain that their liberalism might be imposing on Muslims who don't want their faith to become just a faith. They don't want it to become just a religion. And obviously the ambition of, let's call them Muslim fundamentalists, to uphold an Islam that does not allow for a secular space that occupies a totalizing place within society in the way that they think God has ordained, and that this is humanity's last chance, and that if humanity doesn't take it, then it's all over. You can see that there are bound to be inevitable tensions there, to put it mildly. And I think the great question for European societies, because I think it is it's a bigger problem for European countries than it is for the United States, is what will be the consequence of this process of negotiation? I'm not sure what the answer to that is. Mm. And there are reasons for pessimism and there are reasons for optimism. And I hope that the optimistic perspective wins out.
Mm. So you said as in passing, as though it were really a fait accompli, that Western influence was waning. Do you view this kind of through the lens of the fall of Rome, that there was an empire and then there was a moment at which the empire began to unravel? I mean, how are you viewing the current moment as a historian?
I wouldn't really compare it to Rome. I think that in the United States, there is a particular fascination with Rome because the founding fathers modeled the American Republic on the primordial Roman Republic. And the consequence in turn of that, the lesson of history is the Roman Republic fell, became an autocracy, and then the Roman Empire fell.
Yeah, let's not recapitulate all of that.
Right, right. And it's been an anxiety from the very beginning, so that, you know, when Benjamin Franklin comes out and from the convention to decide what the Constitution should be, and everyone says, what have you decided? Yeah. And he says, a republic, if you can keep it.
Yeah.
So the lessons of, the sense that the Roman Republic ended up in the shadow of an autocracy has been a cause of anxiety to Americans ever since the founding of the Republic. And it's obviously a cause of anxiety for quite a lot of Americans at the moment, I would guess. But I think that's kind of specific perhaps to America. I think that the global preponderance of particularly European empires in the 19th century was such a fleeting, aberrant moment. And the center of gravity in world affairs, historically speaking, has always been with the great civilizations of China and of India, and indeed of the Islamic world, which for centuries were far richer than Europe were. And it's not surprising, you know, the tide of European power came in, and now it's going back out again. And you see the consequences of that in India. You know, it was ruled by the British. The British withdrew, and they left behind a constitution that said that India should be a secular republic. And both of those words derive from Latin. And the notion of the secular derives from the Christian inheritance. And for decades after that, therefore, the secular government of the Republic of India inevitably had, you know, it bore the stamp of the vanished British Raj.
Yeah.
And what you see now with Modi and the notion of Hindutva, the idea that India should return to how the country was before the British came, before the Muslims came, to an age where what the British term the religion of Hinduism was not a religion at all, but was simply the air that every Hindu breathed in.
Mm-hmm.
That is an attempt to scour India more completely clear of colonial influence than Nehru and the early generations of rulers in India had even realized was necessary. Mm. And I think you see the same process, say, in the Islamic world, very interestingly in Turkey, where Ataturk was profoundly influenced by the ideals of the French Revolution and kind of, you know, the notions of laïcité, of the secular. And the great symbol of that was Hagia Sophia, the great Orthodox cathedral that when the Ottomans conquered Constantinople had been turned into a mosque. And so Ataturk, by converting Hagia Sophia, as it had become, into a museum, was saying, we have transcended the religious and now we are a secular state. And now you have Erdogan, who has come back and who has said, no, we're getting rid of that secular ideal. I think because Erdogan correctly, I mean, whether consciously or subliminally, recognizes that secularism is not just a kind of neutral condition, but is a very ideologically pregnant concept that derives from, ultimately, from Christian Europe. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, you know, having this great symbol of Islam's triumph over Christianity in the heart of Turkey's greatest city. I mean, you can see why he would think it was important to reopen Hagia Sophia as a mosque.
Mm. As I said, you and Dominic on your podcast have an amazing series on the French Revolution. I'm wondering if you could distill the lessons that you draw from the French Revolution that might be relevant to the present. What should we have learned from that experience?
Don't back American revolutionaries. Mm-hmm. If you're a king, it's definitely one.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that...
Actually, unpack people, that. That'll be inscrutable to people who are not students
the French and the British have been fighting a series of wars throughout the 18th century. The British have generally had the better of it. And so when the American colonies rebel against their anointed king and refuse to pay their taxes, the French find all kinds of opportunities to make mischief and send lots of money and arms and support to the American revolutionaries, which sees the British Empire in North America, with the exception of Canada, for now. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, who knows what will happen to Canada soon. Sees the British chucked out, certainly, of what becomes the United States. But this results in the French treasury massively overextending itself. And there's a huge debt crisis. This then combines with a series of terrible harvests to precipitate what becomes the French Revolution. I mean, I guess what strikes me about the French Revolution is the intoxicating quality of moral certitude, which I think absolutely you see in the Christian church in the Middle Ages, but I think you see it manifesting itself in the conviction of the revolutionaries that right is on their side, that a new age can be born, that the last shall be first and the first shall be last. And I think that it is inspirational in the way that it enshrines ideals that I think animate Western societies to this day. But I think it is also salutary in the sense that moral conviction in this Christian world in which we, I think, still live can perhaps too easily lead to the kind of certitude that can plunge, if not into violence, as it did in the French Revolution, then certainly into a kind of a shrill Pelagianism. And I better unpick that word. Mm-hmm. So Pelagius was the great rival of Augustine, who said that all humanity is steeped in sin, you know, or even the newborn babe has sin, that sin is original within us, and that therefore we are all sinners and only the grace of God can redeem us. But Pelagius, who I'm proud to say was Britain's first intellectual, came to Rome and he said that human beings can perfect themselves by their own agency, which may sound kind of more optimistic. And I think there's always been a slight Pelagian quality, certainly, to American optimism. But it can also become quite oppressive, because if you can attain virtue under your own steam, then it means that those who can't are the more readily to be condemned. And that certainly what I think the French Revolution can be thought of as a Pelagian revolution.
Well, another lens through which to see that same point is to just consider the dark side of utopianism. You know, the idea that anything is collectively perfectible leaves any failure to perfect it something for which we should have very little tolerance.
Yeah, so I, to my surprise, I have found myself in my old age becoming an Augustinian. I prefer the idea that there is a kind of original sin, a darkness that humans have to guard against, an instinct to dominance that I think is inherent within us, and the notion that we can fashion heaven on earth, the risk is always of creating a hell.
So what most concerns you at this moment as you cast your the gimlet eye of a historian onto current events? You read the newspaper. What are you worried about?
Well, as a European, I feel slightly buffeted by
the
gale force coming out of Washington at the moment. Maybe not, I don't know, maybe not as buffeted as Americans who voted against Trump. But it's not, the world doesn't feel particularly stable at the moment. But I guess, having said that our instincts in the West are Christian in their fundamentals, I think there are ways in which you can see that the hold of Christianity perhaps is fading. And I think one of them is a sense of the possibility that humans are not actually elevated, that we are just animals like every other animal on the face of this planet, that the planet does not exist for our God-given benefit, and that therefore, whether it's the process of climactic change or whether it's the process of mass extinction, which increasingly seems to be of an order that, you know, is coming to rival the previous great mass extinction at the end of the Cretaceous, where will that lead? And I guess that's probably what I find most unsettling and worrying. But I find it so unsettling and worrying that I essentially try not to think about it. I try to put it from my thoughts.
Though you don't shy away from the darkest parts of the human experience, and you're certainly in your podcast. I listened to the series you did on the Congo.
Yeah.
And the Mad Leopold. And also I had just by coincidence recently reread Conrad's Heart of Darkness, which is, I think like every 13-year-old in America, at least at the time I read it. I've read it. I think I read it in college too, but I was just struck at what an amazing novella it is at this point. It's
the
so
horror,
well
the
written.
Horror. Yeah. I mean, I think the story of the Congo, so for those who don't know, it was essentially appropriated by Leopold II, the king of the Belgians, as his private fiefdom. I mean, he is clearly a monster.
Yeah.
He's an utter cynic, an utter opportunist. He dresses up his avarice in fine-sounding moral terms, but he never had any pretensions towards doing good.
Mm.
In a way, he's a kind of easier bogey than the spectacle of people who think that they're doing good and do terrible things.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are you focused on next? Are you writing another book? Are you
podcast land? Just before joining you, I signed the contract for a new book that is in a way a kind of a postscript to Dominion. Because in Dominion, I have 21 chapters, and each chapter begins with a kind of vignette, which provides a kind of clothes hanger from which to hang analysis of a kind of the themes of that chapter. And the penultimate vignette is the Beatles in the studios of Abbey Road doing a live broadcast of All You Need Is Love. And I then did a kind of section on the 60s. And there was so much more I wanted to say about the 60s, because I realized as I was writing about it, that what it reminded me of was the 1520s in the course of the Reformation, the sense of an utter transfiguration of so much that had seemed familiar. And what I think happens in the 60s is that these very ancient, deeply rooted Christian scriptures and habits of worship and habits of church attendance and all these things just are transformed into a vibe and they linger in the air, but they are no longer attached by roots to the soil that had given them birth. Yes. And
they're also supercharged by psychedelics. There's a new sacrament
completely.
In town.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So it's in the 60s that the thesis is advanced that Jesus had actually been a magic mushroom,
which
I will enjoy looking at a great deal. So it's a book about the 60s, which takes the Beatles as a paradigmatic of this great process of transformation, because they rub up against all the great trends. John and Paul meet in a church fete. They hone their craft in post-Nazi Hamburg, where many of the bouncers on the clubs are ex-Nazis.
Mm-hmm. I think you give the details that limbless, they're missing
that's
limbs.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And then, of course, you have Lennon saying they're bigger than Jesus. You have them embracing Eastern religions and all kinds of things. Give peace a chance. So I'm really looking forward to doing that.
Nice. Well, I'm looking forward to reading it. So you better get busy writing it. Well, Tom, it's been great to finally connect with you. As you, I think you can tell, I'm a big
fan.
You. So keep it up.
Well, mutually.
Nice.
So it's been a great honor to be on your podcast.
Well,
thank you for having me.
Whenever you got something to talk about, the door is open.
Thank you.
And certainly when your book on the 60s comes out, I'll be eager to speak with you about it. So
I will make sure a copy is sent directly to you.
Nice.
Blowing on the wind.
Nice.